Imagine a time when the empire was rudderless, the throne of the Holy Roman Empire is empty, and the scramble for power rippled across every corner of the land. Princes, bishops, and nobles seized the moment to expand their influence, but in this chaos an unexpected force began to rise, cities. And at the heart of this urban revolution was the year 1254, when towns along the Rhine defied the odds to form an unprecedented alliance. Welcome to the story of the Rhenish League of Cities. Hello and welcome back to the History of Cologne, a podcast about the city of Cologne that is over 2,000 years old. But until it became what it is today, this old city on the Rhine is endured a colorful and rich past, hence it can therefore be seen as a kind of European microcosm. In this podcast you can listen as the city grows from the Romans up until our present time. Yeah, these are troubled times in this episode, in the empire, in the middle of the 13th century. As was once the case around 50 years ago, in 1200, the imperial throne of the Holy Roman Empire is vacant. Not that there are no candidates, quite the opposite. The candidates are almost queuing up, if not at the same time, but often in quick succession. From all over Europe, during this period, without an emperor, the so-called Interregnum, the Hohenstaufen Conrad, the Thuringian Henry Raspe, Count William of Holland, Alfonso of Castile from the Iberian Peninsula, and the Anglo-Norman Richard of Cornwall attempted to assert themselves as rulers of the empire. But if you're thinking that this is going to be another complicated episode like the one that took place during the dispute over the German throne around 1200, don't worry, this can be shortened very quickly. Some would succeed in being crowned king, yeah, some of these candidates, but none of them were allowed to exercise real power, let alone achieve the title of emperor by the Pope. But 1254, at the latest, when the Hohenstaufen's son Frederick II, Conrad IV, died, the central power in the empire had finally collapsed at the top. This was to continue until 1273, so for such a long time. No emperor in the empire, far and wide, to be seen. But we also know from this more recent times, such a power vacuum at the top is always filled. By whom? All those who were subordinate to that position, of course. Princes, bishops, all of them built their own castles or went about curtailing the local nobility. In other words, local regional rulers centralized power within their sphere of influence and appropriated it directly. And that is one of the major events or eras that made the Holy Roman Empire as fragmented as you would know it later in the early modern period, and especially after the 30 Years' War in the 17th century. Here in Cologne, we're now back in the 13th century, we have already witnessed this. Conrad von Hochstaden, Archbishop of Cologne and also secular ruler of Cologne, who tried to amass more power and wealth even before the small arbitration discussed in the last episode. But alongside the princes and the bishops, there was a third party that was able to profit from this interregnum, the period of no emperors around, in the middle of the 13th century, and that was the cities. Cities like our Cologne. This led to a hitherto unusual event. From 1254 onwards, towns and cities along the Rhine allied with each other in order to be armed against princes and bishops and other external dangers. Let's take a closer look at that right after the intro. The year 1254 marks an early turning point in the Interregnum, the period without an emperor, which was to last until 1273, as I already said. Since the death of Emperor Frederick II, who was celebrated as the, quote, wonder of the world, or, quote, the greatest prince of his time, end quote, during his lifetime, the empire had already been in a phase of political instability. The situation was further exacerbated when his son and successor Conrad IV died just 4 years after Frederick's death in 1254, the year we are in right now. It was a time of instability and, above all, fighting and rivalries within the empire increased. Everyone within the empire with some power wanted to take advantage of the instability to gain more power for themselves. Counts, dukes, and bishops shamelessly exploited this phase, levied new taxes, confiscated the goods of traveling merchants, generally expanded their powers, and, as already mentioned, built new fortifications, all stuff that they, in normal times, would have asked for at the imperial or royal court. The dispute over minting rights in Cologne mentioned in the last episode we had, which ended in the small arbitration, should be seen against this background as well. But if all the local and regional rulers in the empire began to levy more taxes and expand their power, who would be harmed? Precisely those who were dependent on traveling through the empire. This mainly affected merchants and long-distance traders. And they mainly lived, that's right, you guessed it, in cities. In an era full of conflict between noble families, bishops, and towns, the Rhenish League of Cities was intended to offer mutual protection among themselves, but above all, against powers outside of this confederation. The idea of an alliance between cities was nothing new in 1254 in medieval Europe. Especially the northern Italian cities in Lombardy and Tuscany had already been quite successful together against the Hohenstaufen imperial armies from time to time with a system like that. What was new now was the large scale in the empire north of the Alps. The first of these were towns along the Middle Rhine, in other words, south of Cologne. This was not surprising. This is where the Hohenstaufen Conrad IV had his power base in addition to southwest Germany. But after his death in 1254, the power vacuum was particularly noticeable here. In February 1254, the Middle Rhine cities of Mainz and Worms decided to make a start and formed the League. This, funnily enough, was actually strictly forbidden under the laws of the empire, under the laws of the time, especially under Frederick II as emperor. But, you know, Frederick II was already dead. His son Conrad IV was in a faraway Italian city or countryside and, as we know, would die in a few weeks in 1254. This set a chain reaction in motion, and more towns along the Rhine in both directions joined the Rhenish League of Cities. For example, the towns of Boppard, Frankfurt, and even Colmar in Alsace. And Cologne? Well, how can I put it with Cologne? So far, our beloved cathedral city has always been able to rely on its mighty big city wall. And for the time being, they remain true to their own line, I mean, the people of Cologne, staying politically flexible in uncertain times. But not quite this time. The Archbishop himself, Conrad of Hochstaden, joined the alliance early on in 1254. Only the citizens, who had long been independent of the city's ruler in terms of foreign policy, remained reluctant at first. But perhaps it was the memories of the German throne dispute not to be completely alone again in such troubling times, and the leading rich families of Cologne, such as the Oberstolzens, the Hardefust, or the Weisen von der Mühlengasse, perhaps felt the pressure from the common people not to experience such harsh conditions again. So it was when a meeting of the League of Rhenish Cities in October 1254 formally invited the citizens of Cologne to join the League, that they could not say no. On 12 January 1255, Cologne officially became a full member of the Confederation, the League of Rhenish Cities, and one of the four main towns, along with Worms, Strasbourg, Mainz, where the Confederation would meet regularly in one of those four places. Nevertheless, the leading citizens of Cologne kept a somewhat conspicuous low profile even after the accession. Especially the Riecher Zeche, the Brotherhood of the Rich, the richest families in the city, and especially the jurors of the city, at the Council of the Jurors. As you know, these three elements are usually overlapping anyway. Rich families, the Riecher Zeche, and the jurors. All of the jurors were automatically members of the Riecher Zeche, the city of Cologne's wealthiest alliance, and most of them came from Cologne's richest families. But whoever stepped up to represent Cologne in the League of Cities was, surprised, the young Cologne City Council, which did not yet have the power it would later have as the city's highest body. It was still in its infancy, so to speak, and played a minor role until then, alongside the old institutions such as the College of Jurors and the semi-official Club of the Rich, the Richerzeche. But this is where it really stood out, the City Council of Cologne. An important step forward for this young Cologne City Council. And since we often look at the European perspective here, other cities in the Rhineland also underwent the same development. The city councils of Aachen and Neuss also took advantage of the passive behavior of the old bourgeois elites to give themselves more political scope and power. And when Cologne became a member of the League of Cities and recruited members itself, especially in Westphalia, councillors were always listed among the exhibitors. And conversely, responses to these inquiries were also sent to the Cologne City Council. Yeah, but now a small spoiler. The Rhenish League of Cities would not survive for long. Whatever the development described here, the rise in power of the city council, in general, would be more sustainable. But let's not talk about the end of the League of Rhenish Cities yet, but get more into detail. The good thing is that this already mentioned invitation letter to Cologne to join the Rhenish League of Cities has been preserved up until the present day. Like all council records, it is now in the historical archive of the city of Cologne. Let's read what it says, translated from Latin into High German, of course, for you. In English, I got a translated version of it into High German, and then I translated into English for you. But please bear in mind that typical for medieval documents, the beginning lists all those who already belong to the league. Those are the people addressing Cologne to join them. So be aware, there are quite a few city names now following, and some nobles as well, and bishops. But we have to get through it, so let's start. Quote, Gerhard of Mainz and Conrad of Cologne, archbishops by the grace of God, the bishops of Worms and Basel, Conrad the Elder and Emicho the Younger, Wildgraves, Gerlach of Limburg and Ulrich of Münzenberg, noblemen, all citizens of Mainz, Worms, Speyer, Hagenau, Straßburg, Basel, Schlettstadt, Colmar, Breisach, Frankfurt, Gelnhausen, Wetzlar, Friedberg, Oppenheim, Bingen, Oberwesel, Bacharach, Diebach and Boppard, to the provident and honorable man, the judges, aldermen, the jurors, and the other city councillors. This is now a note from me, by me, important, remember that, and citizens of Cologne's. We greet them with sincere love. So that's the intro, dear people. I should have said end quote, I guess. But let's continue with the document. With the present letter, we confess and declare publicly that we have vouched and taken a physical oath that we will maintain the general peace of the land from the recent Feast of Margaret, meaning July 13, 1254, until the end of the next 10 years with all diligence and pure loyalty, and will do our utmost to ensure it, that it shall be faithfully, validly, and inviolably observed by all, according to the forms, conditions, and rules more fully contained in the instrument executed for the preservation of this peace. This we will keep and fulfill in full against anyone who does us or you harm or violence. But in order that the foregoing may be fully believed, we have signed the present deed with the seals. And this, end quote, dear people, is where the document breaks off. It is lost to us. But we can assume that this is followed by the numerous seals of the persons and towns named in the document now saying, hey, Cologne, join our club, please. But here we learn something in this document about what this leak was all about. This was above all, firstly, I have no idea. The first thing was the abolition of unlawful custom duties that were introduced in recent times by all those noblemen that wanted to get more power. Second thing was securing trade routes, obviously, above all the Rhine as a long-distance waterway in the empire, as the long-distance waterway in the empire. And third thing was the associated protection against attacks by nobles or other cities outside this alliance. Because, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on. People want to get more power and try to take it, because there's no emperor around preventing that. The member towns of the Rhenish League of Cities undertook to hold annual assemblies and to support each other militarily. It was a defense alliance. It was an attempt at municipal self-help at a time when imperial authority was only a shadow of its former self, as there was simply no powerful emperor in the middle like Otto or Barbarossa. There's also an interesting passage in the letter that I, in this document better said, that I briefly called out to you, and I told you to remember it. There, the Cologne jurors, judges, and city councillors are greeted and mentioned. The Cologne City Council is named in a supra-regional and important document. This had never happened before. This is the first time the city council is at the same level with all those other institutions. This is also reflected in the delegates that Cologne sent to the meetings of the League of Rhenish Cities. The four Cologne representatives did not come from the College of Jurors, though up until then the most important self-governing body at the time, which was formerly an instrument of power of the archbishop, but which had since become virtually independent under the control of the city's richest families. No, as I said, the richest families in Cologne tended to shy away from the League of Rhenish Cities. As a document from the town of Zinzig regarding its accession to the Rhenish League of Cities in 1255 also explicitly names four Cologne citizens, that historian Manfred Groden assumes that they were also the four representatives of the city. Non-jurors, but perhaps councillors, city councillors, who represented Cologne at the meetings of the Rhenish League of Cities. And these were Hildegard von Lüskirchen, Matthias von der Lindgasse, Heinrich Hahne, and Waldheim von der Aducht. So you see, even here in this super important League of Rhenish Cities, it is the Cologne councilman taking the place. That all sounds great, doesn't it, about the Rhenish League of Cities? But it was a short-lived institution. On 6th January 1256, a federal conference was still held in Cologne. But the following year, the League broke up. In 1257, another royal election was held in the empire, another chance to end the interregnum, to unite behind a ruler in the empire. But that did not happen. In 1257, not just one, but two kings were elected. How was that possible? For the first time, a fixed electoral body convened, which alone was responsible for electing the new king in the empire. It no longer consisted of a wild assortment of princes and bishops as before. No, it now consisted of just seven single men. These were three ecclesiastical and four secular princes. The three ecclesiastical princes were the archbishops of Mainz, Trier, and, drumroll, Cologne, of course. The four secular rulers were the Count Palatine of the Rhine, the Duke of Saxony, the Margrave of Brandenburg, and the King of Bohemia. If you're not sure where all these rulers reign in the empire, take a look at my homepage, thehistoryofcologne.com. You will find a corresponding map there. But if there were only seven votes, what a clear system. I mean, Think of how other elections go in other countries nowadays in the modern world. How could this, with only 7 votes, be a double election? One of the candidates only had to receive at least 4 votes to win. But the problem was that both candidates, Afonso of Castile and Richard of Cornwall, each received 4 votes. How is that possible if there are only 7 voters? Both candidates, in the first place, won 3 votes each. The King of Bohemia, however, the 7th man in this circle, played his own game to tip the scales. He allowed himself to be bribed, paid, for his generosity by both candidates and gave them both his votes, seeing who is the better candidate who would give him more in the end. Thus, the stalemate. Both candidates had a majority because of the King of Bohemia voting for both. Crazy. However, this dispute as to which of the two was the true rightful king also made some heated discussions among the members of the Rhenish League of Cities, which had now grown to include several dozen cities, princes, and even bishops. Here too, no agreement was reached. They could not agree on who is now the true king. And this meant that after just a few years, the Rhenish League of Cities was already history in 1257. But why is the League of Rhenish Cities still worth mentioning, and why has it found its way into the podcast here? For 2 reasons, of course. You've already heard the first one. The Cologne City Council, but also the councils of other cities, gained enormous power in their respective municipalities in this period. The second point, which is just as important, is that although some bishops and even princes had also joined the Rhenish League of Cities, this short-lived institution was mainly supported and even initiated by cities, something that had not really existed before in the empire. The existence of the Rhenish League of Cities, even if it was only brief, illustrated something that was to characterize the end of the High Middle Ages and the start of the Late Middle Ages. Even though around 90% of people in Europe north of the Alps still lived in the countryside, an era of cities had dawned. This put an end to the often still widespread misconception that the Middle Ages were just a dark, backward time, because in no other era were so many cities founded in Europe as in the High Middle Ages. Never again later that time. Really. You don't believe me? Well, around the year 1150, there were only 200 places in the Holy Roman Empire that could be described as a town or as a city. But between the years 1240 and 1300, hold on tight into your seats and listen carefully, people, around 300 additional towns were founded every single year. The medieval warm period, which created a better climate and improved farming methods, produced surpluses that generated enormous population growth. It was supposedly so warm that it was even possible to grow good wine in Norway. This created a spirit of optimism among the people of that time. At the time of Otto the Great and his direct successors around the year 1000, so at the end of the early Middle Ages, around 4 million people lived in the empire. In 1340, shortly before the outbreak of the Black Death, there were 14 million. Cologne may have had around 5,000 to 10,000 inhabitants around the year 1000. In the late Middle Ages, there were 40,000. This aforementioned spirit of optimism from 1150 onwards also manifested itself in this enormous wave of city foundations. But stop, please don't think of cities or towns as today's urban centers. A town often meant a few hundred to perhaps 2,000 to 5,000 inhabitants, also focusing mainly on agriculture. Cologne, with almost 40,000 inhabitants, was far from the largest city in the empire, and thus also one of the largest cities in Europe in terms of population, in the same league as London or Paris. But the basic features that characterize cities today were of course still present back then in a small town with a few hundred or thousand inhabitants. division of labor, cooperative groupings among craftsmen and merchants, firmly defined space, whether by a wall or something else, various forms of autonomy of the urban community from the prince, bishop, or whatever ruler, just as we already know it from medieval Cologne. And, of course, market rights above all. To have the right to have a market that provided the economic basis for a city to grow. Of course, this growth had consequences. Many harsh, hard consequences. But I would like to focus on one particular aspect in particular to make that clear to you guys. I'm sure that if humanity survives our humanity in our present times, later researchers will refer to us as the people of an age of oil and plastic. Crude oil is the resource of our time, whether as an energy source, fuel, or as an ingredient for our industry, medicine, or most of our consumer goods made of plastic. To create this podcast, I need a lot of oil to produce it. crude oil is everywhere. The High and Late Middle Ages were again characterized by an enormous demand for wood, because wood covered almost exactly as much of the aforementioned demand as we have for oil today. All the new towns in the Middle Ages craved timber. More people also meant more demand for wood to generate heat in the houses, more wood for the heat to be able to process more raw materials such as glass, metal, or clay. Wood was in great demand. Just one example. 30 kilos of charcoal were needed to produce 1 single kilogram of iron. And if you're an American and you don't know what kilograms is, this is fine, but just compare the numbers. 30 kilos of charcoal for just 1 kilogram of iron. And this 30 kilos of charcoal was obtained from 200 kilograms of raw wood. A huge amount. To just create, you need 200 kilograms of fresh wood to produce 1 kilogram of iron. A huge amount, as I said. All trade was also dependent on wood. Ships, carts, barrels, everything was made from wood in vast quantities. Crossing a stream along a trade route, you need a bridge for that. And what is that bridge mostly made of? Of wood, of course. Cologne Cathedral was being built. Well, why do we need wood? It's a cathedral made out of stone. No, wood is needed for many production steps, just for the scaffolding on the huge building. We can see from recent times just how much wood was needed to build churches in the Middle Ages. Surely you all remember the tragic fire in the roof truss of Notre Dame de Paris in France in 2019? When the building was rebuilt, the aim was to reconstruct it true to the original. The roof of Notre Dame was to look like the medieval one, again, the one that burnt down in 2019. This means that the roof truss is made of wood again, unlike the 19th century steel roof truss of Cologne Cathedral. For the wooden roof truss of the Paris Cathedral, 2,000, and this is just a fact, no judgment, please, don't misunderstand me, it's just a fact, but for the roof truss of Paris Cathedral, 2,000 old oak trees were felled in France alone, and it takes a good 180 to 300 years for an oak tree to reach maturity. This was also true of the forests in the Middle Ages. The Lüneburg Heath was once full of forests and trees, but the salt deposits there wanted to be exploited in the Middle Ages. What fueled the brewing pans to gain that salt? Wood, of course. Only then did the great Lüneburg Heath, with its cultural landscape as we know it today, come into being. Salt, a raw material just as important as wood before the invention of refrigerators for preserving food. But we don't have to look so far afield. Cologne itself sourced its wood from far beyond the right banks of the Rhine, or from areas on today's Upper Rhine in the south, such as the Black Forest. The felled timber was floated on large rafts on the Rhine to Cologne with the current for many dozens, even hundreds of kilometers or miles. But, and that honors the Middle Ages of antiquity, people realized what damage the massive extraction of wood was causing to the environment and ecology. From 1200 onwards, rulers increasingly focused on protecting the forests and issued rules and bans on its use. They did that, of course, not because they were green or something else. They just wanted to have a forest they could still use economically. This naturally caused the price of wood to rise even higher, and above all, exclude the poor from the forest area, which had previously been regarded as common property. You know, like if you have some pigs, you just go out into the woods and let them search for stuff to eat in the woods. That was not allowed anymore. Or you would walk into the woods into the forest to collect some tree branches that were falling off the trees to collect and take home. This was also often forbidden now and led to social unrest. The developments of the 13th century, be it the brief episode of the Rhenish League of Cities, the growing influence of the cities and their councils, or the increasing importance and number of towns in general, marks a transition to the late Middle Ages, or mark the transition to the late Middle Ages. So, the conclusion. The Rhenish League of Cities was an important step in the development of local self-government and the urban system along the Rhine, even if it was short-lived, just 3 years. Cologne benefited from this by strengthening its position as a trading metropolis and political player. In Cologne itself, the still relatively young city council was able to emancipate itself somewhat from the city's older political institutions. This was because the College of Jurors remained largely passive, at least the majority of them did. That concludes our episode for this time. Next episode, we will go back to Cologne itself. Well, today we had a more regional perspective, but next time there's trouble again in Cologne, fights in Cologne, even warlike situations in Cologne, because you might have guessed it, the Cologne citizens and the Archbishop, still Konrad von Hochstaden, yes, he has a long reign, they are fighting against each other again about rights, money, and power, of course. The literature used for this episode was, of course, Hugo Stehkämper's and Karl Dietmar's Köln im Hochmittelalter, so Cologne in the High Middle Ages. Then another book called, long title, sorry, Gründerzeit 1200, wie das Mittelalter unsere Städte erfand, so Founding Period of 1200, How the Middle Ages Invented Our Cities, by Gisela Greichen and Matthias Wemhoff. Really a good read, even for non-scholars. And another classic in this podcast, Manfred Grotens, Die Deutsche Stadt im Mittelalter, or in English, The German City in the Middle Ages. Manfred Grotens also edited, translated, and analyzed the text with which the city of Cologne was invited to its center by the Rhenish League of Cities. Dear all, it's the end of 2024, at least when this episode is released. I wish you and your loved ones a Merry Christmas, or if you don't celebrate it, Happy Holidays and a Happy New Year. As always, I'm taking a short Christmas break from the podcast, but I'll see you again in January, and hey, the podcast at the end of January turns 5. Wow. Half a century. Who would have guessed? Thanks to Paul, Jürgen, Martin, Ingo, Antje and Christian for your tips via PayPal. Thanks to Kreuz Erbe for your funny username, by the way, for your membership on Patreon to support this podcast regularly. Recommend me further, rate this podcast wherever you listen to it, and auf Wiedersehen.